The most fundamental relationship in any change process is the one that you have with yourself. It's the quiet conversations that you have with yourself. It's the questions that you ask yourself first and foremost that are the game changers. It's, do I feel allowed to do the thing that I think I should, or they say I should? Do I really feel allowed to do it? Or does fear intervene in my own sense of permission? Are there external authorities whose power over me is so great that I'm not willing to take a risk? Or am I the thing that's in the way of me actually taking a risk to do something different?
Ken here. I promise you the rest of my conversation with Jill Riley from Cape Town, South Africa, is just as thought-provoking. But first, I wanted to share something extraordinary with you. Last week's episode pushed curated questions past 100,000 downloads. To put that in perspective, watching a recent Dallas Cowboys game, I realized their massive stadium holds 80,000 people. You, this community of questioners, would fill that stadium and still have 20,000 people outside. That's remarkable. What moves me most is how this community continues to grow through your actions. You listen, find value, and then share these conversations with others who need them. Our top five countries, the United States, India, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Philippines, show how questions transcend borders. I've never aimed to compete with the Joe Rogans of the world. My intent has always been to connect fellow travelers on this journey of curiosity, to build an ecosystem where thoughtful questioning helps us all thrive. Thank you for being partners in this. Thank you for taking these questions into your daily lives and making a difference in your local communities. You're proving that the right question at the right moment can change everything. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you're here. Today's conversation is with Jill Riley. Jill has lived as a global citizen, leaving behind the familiarity of her Midwestern life at the age of 23 for South Africa, leading up to its first democratic elections. She then went to Zimbabwe to help battle the HIV/AIDS crisis, which after significant reflection, she wrote the book Shame, Confessions of an Aid Worker in Africa, and gave a TED Talk titled Vain Aid. Other places she has called home include England, New York, Tanzania, and France. I'm certain the passport reflects plenty more additions. Jill's extensive experience in cultural intelligence and adult learning methodologies, combined with her personal experience, has produced hard-won insights. She has witnessed people stuck in a culture or family narrative who have felt powerless throughout their lives. Jill's latest book, The 10 Permissions, Redefining the Rules of Adulting in the 21st Century, serves as a blueprint for personal agency in a time of significant upheaval. Never has peering into the crystal ball about the future been more cloudy. Perhaps giving ourselves permission is the first step towards clarity. Jill, welcome to Curated Questions.
Oh, thank you so much. Gosh, I enjoyed your introduction so much. I think I might steal some of your lines there, particularly the one about permission is the first step in giving us clarity. I love it. And I'm so grateful to be here.
Excellent. I am glad we were able to connect. Mm. And your story was very compelling and wanting to have this conversation. Great. So I am looking forward to all that will unfold through this conversation.
Yeah, me too. I love your framing of yourself as a fellow traveler in this whole journey of exploration. So yeah, I'm excited to dig in.
Beautiful. I always like to start folks at the same point, and that is with the question, when did you first understand the power of questions?
Yeah. And I think it was when I, at a very young age, as you reference, was in sort of deep explorer mode. I was this young American woman of privilege, you know, from the Midwest, graduate of Northwestern University, who landed in South Africa in 1993 and found myself in so many rooms where I was the only one who didn't speak the language, the only one who looked like me. And I quickly realized that all I had were questions. You know, questions were the ways that I created connection. Questions were the ways that I, to use my own language, began to establish permission between and among myself and other people to just get to know each other as humans. I realized that if I walked into rooms without questions, then my baggage, if you will, would probably precede me as white American in this country with such a torrid past, that they were like little invitations, my questions, to just connect in the moment as who we were. And gosh, the subsequent 10 years and on just proved to me that they're the most valuable thing that you have when you enter into any room, because it's how you, it's how you learn, it's how you connect. And I quickly learned that leading with questions was how I established a sense of safety, because people could sense that I was curious, that all I wanted to do was know more. So yeah, at a very early age, very, very far away from home, I realized that questions were the things that were going to be my avenue forward.
So if we can take a step back into how is it that you chose to pursue going to South Africa, because as it seems to me that there's definitely a story tucked in between 23-year-old Midwestern, Northwestern, and showing up in South Africa.
There's a story.
I know that there's some upheaval that happened there, so I'm really curious about that.
Yeah, well, there was, you know, all sorts of, I would say, upheaval combined with unraveling. I mean, I went to Northwestern, which has, I think still, certainly at the time that I was there, had the largest African studies program and African studies library outside of Africa. So I was required as part of my liberal arts degree to take a non-Western history class. And I took this class on modern Southern African history. And for reasons that I don't have the language for, became really captivated by this story of reinvention, this story of, you know, what this country was trying to do to carve a path forward away from what had been one of the most racist, unjust histories on the planet. And, you know, I think I just began to feel more and more that I wanted to live in service, to work in service of something bigger than myself. And at 19, 20, 21, I didn't know what that meant, but I knew it was important enough for me to go looking after it. I knew that it wasn't something that I wanted to ignore. And maybe that was enough for me. It obviously was enough for me, because I had been all set up back in the early 90s. It was like, if you graduated from a place like Northwestern, you went to one of the big four consultancies, you went to law school. That was the path you took. And I chose not to. And I chose to pursue something that was this very, you know, vague sense of meaning and purpose that was sort of unfolding inside of me. And my parents were, that's where the upheaval is. There was a lot of upheaval around various dinner tables. But I think what I learned early, which was unbelievably valuable, is that approval isn't the same as permission. I didn't need their permission to do what I wanted to do. I was going into adulthood. I was going to fund the whole thing myself. Their disapproval did not mean that I was not allowed to go. I think a lot of people conflate approval with permission, that people have to buy into what I want to do. And it's like, no, they don't. As long as you feel solid enough about it and are prepared to deal with the consequences. I mean, it could have been a complete disaster and I would have had to own that and deal with it. But, you know, I started to listen in to my own sense of, yeah, emerging direction, and I followed it. And gosh, there were so many unknowns attached to it, but luckily, it led mostly to really wonderful experiences and wonderful learning experiences.
As we'll be talking about your book, 10 Permissions, of just that word permissions, mm-hmm. It sounds like you gave yourself permission mm-hmm. at some point to follow this. Mm. But even prior to that, the fact that you would even consider making that step mm-hmm. and putting the plans in place, right? Whether it was in the class or whatever it was, at some point there was something that happened that you're like, yeah, I think that this is something worth doing. Not only that, but I'm actually going to go make it happen.
Yeah.
That takes just sheer guts.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it did. And looking back, I'm sort of like, wow, okay, you go, girl. You did well there. since we're digging, I mean, I didn't grow up in a particularly happy household in that we had all the trappings. My parents were typical boomers. And I do think this forms a backstory to the book, which is my father lived the dream of that period in the world where he worked his way up from the factory floor to management. We had everything. He accumulated more and more. It was supposed to be the dream. And what I saw were two not very happy people, and particularly my mother, who, if you referenced at the beginning of the introduction, people stuck in stories. I mean, I certainly watched a woman who was stuck in a story that she felt no power whatsoever to rewrite. So I think if you want to dig back further, it was, okay, I'm not buying that this is what good looks like. I'm not buying it. And I'm not going to accept the fact that this is supposedly the only path I'm allowed to value. And, you know, for me, the theme of permission is digging into a lot of the default stories that shape our choices without us even knowing it. And the fact that there was this assumption that your primary goal in life was to put yourself on a path of greater material accumulation and a bigger house and more TVs. And it's not that I essentially believe that's wrong for everybody. It's just that in line with the theme of your podcast, were we allowed to question it? Were we allowed to create alternatives to it? So I think in some ways the gutsy move was a kind of, well, you know, I'm going to go way off the path in order to go out and find out if there's something more, if there's something else. I think I hadn't bought into the story that was an implicit part of my upbringing. And there were no alternatives at the time. I mean, what else did you do? So I decided to really head out and create my own.
It's an interesting point. If the choices are limited to the stereotypical path that you were talking about of this is what you do once you graduate Northwestern, it's that or nothing other than something seemingly just outlandish.
Right.
That it's revealing that we're not set up to have perhaps the conversations, maybe around the dinner table or at the next step in our communities, to say, what are the things that you could do?
Right.
Now, today, with people being TikTok stars, that seems like that's more paths are being discussed when kids come home and say, yeah, I want to play games and have people watch me and make money. That seems kind of outlandish almost. But as I just reflect back, because we're roughly the same age. It was graduating high school in 88, didn't have a lot of money. So military's the option.
Right.
Okay. And
I don't know if I ever would have even conceived of doing something like going to this other side of the world and actually seeking to help. And I didn't even have that as a category. So my options were, I think, pretty much one as far as how I quickly down selected. But I just think it's an interesting conversation to have about the many paths that could be taken.
Right.
At least have the conversation.
At least have the conversation. And, you know, my book, Ken, is with it. The do-gooder in me is still alive and kicking and hoping that it contributes to those. And the backdrop of the book is that a lot of the default paths that we're supposed to reward and provide the security and safety that we are supposed to crave are not rewarding, are not providing the security and safety that they once did. So within that context, you are forced to consider other paths. You've got to, as I often say, you've got to, you get to. So there's never been a better time to have the conversation, because you can't rely on the sort of default to good grades, good school, good job, good whatever. The moment is requiring a little more invention than it did previously, and it's allowing for it. And yet a lot of us aren't stepping into that. And that's where my theme of permission comes in, which is, do we even feel allowed to have those conversations? I've got a 17-year-old, so I find myself sort of super conscious of that. Am I defaulting to just take the next safest step? Or am I allowing him and myself to consider that I don't even know what safety looks like anymore? So isn't it a good opportunity to begin to explore a variety of options? And maybe you return back to the ones that are most familiar. Maybe you don't. But we can't rely on the go-to options anymore. So surely it's a good time to give ourselves permission to consider more, other, different, unique.
Yes, I would submit, because if we don't, they're just going to be thrust upon us. And then you're scrambling.
Well, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I'm speaking about this through a parental lens right now, because I think it's primarily my kids who are going to be contending with this. But are we preparing them for this evolving reality? Or are we continuing to default to what worked in our day or what we've always done? And then, as you say, it's a matter of time before the reality of today is thrust upon them. And will they be prepared for it? Or will they still kind of go, but wait, you know, I've got my university degree. I did well. I've got my straight A's. And it's like, guess what? That system that promised you rewards for doing those things, it's not rewarding you in the way that it once did. So in many ways, the book is a call to kind of reimagine how we prepare ourselves wherever we are to be more adaptive and imaginative. And coming back into the theme of your podcast, I think questions and questioning sits right in the middle of that.
Absolutely. How did things go when you got to South Africa? And I know how the elections turned out. I know that part.
Yeah.
But how did that work out for you? And whatever the work was that you were doing, was that fulfilling, thrilling, and all the other things like that?
Yeah, all the ings, fulfilling, thrilling. Mm. And I think what I realized, again, and this comes back to your theme, was that, you know, I was in a process of daily discovery. I was in a process of daily exploration. And within that was so much room and so much space that I don't think I'd experienced before. I think when I went away to college, I felt a little bit of that spreading out. But this was like, wow, you know, a stretch beyond anything I'd experienced before in terms of just reintroducing yourself to strangers over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And what that does is, of course, give you the opportunity to say, wait, who am I? How am I introducing myself? What am I about? One of the permissions in the book is take it outside and experiment, because the process of stepping into the new is a process of discovery and rediscovery. It's like, okay, I got to narrate myself to other people. I've got to learn about them. And it's such an amazing, enriching process, particularly when you're 20 something and you're really in an active kind of learning state. So I felt unbelievably lucky. And when I tell my kids that there were no phones, there was no social media, I'd call my parents once a week, if that. I was out there and it just felt like freedom. And I think to come back around to what my drivers were at an early age, it was that, because what I saw was people who got trapped in a story of stuff and of striving and of never having enough and always wanting more. And I was sort of like, gosh, this feels good to just be out in the world, finding my way. So I got a full-time job with an American nonprofit that was funded by the US government, and had a wonderful woman who I worked for who quickly started dispatching me across Africa to design projects, write things. My ability to write was a huge advantage for me. So, gosh, I got to see most of the continent and do things that I even look back on now and go, wow, okay. You know, you got on that ferry. You went and had dinner with that chief. I was up for it. And the world was incredibly kind to me. And so I have a largely optimistic view of humans, which I'm holding on to with both hands right now. It's very easy to get sucked into the pessimism of the moment. But no, it was an amazing, amazing education for this young woman.
You'd mentioned questions and engaging people. Mm. What do you think were some of, not necessarily the specific questions, but kind of the modality and spirit and heart posture as you use questions to engage this new world to you?
Ooh. So I'm going to zone in on a particular time, which was I ended up getting a big job at a young age to run an HIV/AIDS program. I was 27 and I was in charge of a multi-million dollar budget to run an HIV/AIDS program in Zimbabwe when Zimbabwe had the highest incidence rate in the world. And this was pre-treatment, pre-everything. So I stepped into an epidemic, essentially. And if you want to talk about questions, you know, you got to learn quickly. But also, as a young American white woman who was the director of the project, I was the big cheese. And I was the one who was always given a chair. I was the one who was always almost like literally put up on a pedestal because, you know, here she is. And I guess that was particularly when I found questions and opportunity to establish a much more open line of dialogue, not just extraction. You know, it wasn't just me finding out more about the problem. It was me trying to understand the lives of the people who were immersed in it. And so I would often, you know, if everybody was sitting on the floor, I'd sit on the floor. If all the questions were about the epidemic or the science of it or whatever, I'd ask about people's kids, their families. One thing I learned was that when you start talking to people about their families, about the people they love, you establish this immediate human bond, because everybody's got a mother and a father, and most adults have a partner, a somebody. And so to just connect on that universal level was like, oh, okay, we're all in this together. And I still try and come back to that at times now when the world feels so unbelievably polarized, and to just find connectors that are universally human. And the same for me. Obviously, that invited them to ask the same questions of me. So yeah, trying to just engage, you talked about at a heart level. We all love and we all want to be loved. And so the more that you come into that space, it's like, yeah, this great sort of opening, I think, to just the general humanity of a conversation.
I've got a specific memory of that period of time. Now, I'm in central Arizona, but the scare that HIV and AIDS were and the uncertainty. I remember specifically, I don't remember where I was at, but specifically the conversation was, can you contract AIDS from a public toilet seat?
Yeah, sure.
Right. This was, we didn't know. Mm-mm. As humanity, we didn't know. And there was so much uncertainty. And so that I kind of project that kind of thinking of where I was at that time to you stepping into this role and seeking to be there to care and find a way through amidst all the uncertainty of things that were going on. And I'm just like, wow. And then, so the other, I'll tell this other quick story because I want to give a shout out to this guy. After the Navy, got a job with Hughes Network Systems, and I was a technical trainer, and a guy from Zimbabwe, Ray Nyamande.
Okay.
He was a student, and we quickly became friends. So this is obviously in the adult learning space, so much so that he ended up staying with us for a little while in between classes and just dear friend. So I just reconnected with him yesterday.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. I told him that we were having this conversation and you had a connection to Zimbabwe.
Okay.
So as a result, this is just spurring or bringing up all these good feelings of positive energy for the people of Zimbabwe because of that connection that I had.
Yeah. So many tremendous people who I met along the way, many of whom left because of course at the time, it wasn't just the HIV/AIDS epidemic they were dealing with. It was the rise of political instability, the revenge of Robert Mugabe. It was an amazing, I was about to say, which sounds positive, but to witness people trying to confront this double whammy of a sexually transmitted epidemic and their so-called leader tearing their country apart, I was humbled almost every single day in terms of trying to understand what an appropriate role for me was. And I currently reach back into that memory bank quite a lot as I think about what it's like to feel helpless, what it's like to not understand, you know, what's going on, why things don't make sense. As you say, a time of deep uncertainty, a time of deep not knowing. And it left an incredible impression upon me in terms of being present for that. As I describe in my first book, I was present for the dawn of a reinvention of one country and then the sort of falling apart of another. And I would say that both experiences shaped my own perspectives on human beings and change. And as you said in your opening, the stuff that I bring to my work today is hard won and deeply held and, gosh, a product of so much wonderful exposure to other people who taught me so much. And I was a young woman just learning a lot from the people around me. And so I learned a lot from Zimbabweans and continue to, be in touch with so many of them still today.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others.
Wonderful. Well, then touching on the figure, we might as well go there because of where we're at in this time. What do you think are good questions to use when wrestling with political uncertainty, upheaval, and the like?
I think questions around feelings and fear that come with curiosity rather than judgment that allow for people to share the things that really scare them. Because I think that's what happens in these moments is that you start to hold a lot of these feelings in. And when they do come out, because you've held them for so long, you know, their anger, their vitriol. But I think the root of them, there's just so much fear and sadness, lots of sadness for what no longer is, for what you don't understand. And I think sometimes if we can dig into, again, just the human experience of grief, like I've been writing quite a lot now about how I think we're grieving so much of what we once knew and what we once counted on and what we once believed in as the stories that shaped our understanding of how the world worked. And now we don't have them. And frankly, you know, we weren't raised to believe that we could write new ones. Am I going to be the one to try and, you know, fill the void that's being created right now with something new, something better? Or is our only option to try and patch together what once was and keep hobbling along? So I think we've got to acknowledge and have conversations about our sense of loss, our sense of sadness, our sense of fear, because I think those sit at the root of what often gets projected publicly as something else. And I think if we don't converse around those and get curious about those, we also lose the opportunity to turn them into something that has more agency, that has more of a sense of creative power. Like, if we don't acknowledge that we're grieving a story that promised us certain things in exchange for certain behaviors, and that's what I think we are grieving, you know, if you work hard, your company won't fire you. You can work there until you retire. I mean, that was a story that shaped my father's world anyway. And it allowed us a sense of, oh, okay, then I know what to do. I understand this playing field. But that's gone now. And so I don't know how to behave anymore in a way that's going to garner me rewards. And that leaves me feeling lost. It leaves me feeling like confused. It feels unfair. And so I think if I'm not able to engage with those feelings, then there's no way for me to then start to create alternatives, right? I just end up getting stuck in a sense of nostalgia or resentment for the fact that I don't get that story that my father got. Like, I'm playing in something that's far more uncertain and chaotic than he did. I think we've got to allow ourselves to dig into the feeling side of all of this in order to access some of the things that might help us to use this time to create the alternatives that I think we're actually craving.
So, just thank you for that. As you were talking through, you're just naming a lot and giving space for, oh, all right. So as I go back through this, I've got a lot of unpacking to do just with that. Being able to identify the feelings and give space for them, was remarkable words. And calling it grief, I hadn't considered that before until you mentioned that. Like, something shifted in me when you mentioned that. Because there is such grief for, as I'm witnessing things. That just really resonated. And then to the point of, whatever we're going to build that's new, what felt like to me, just even talking through that, is it's at least let's acknowledge the grief, let's give space for that, and then that can now give space for the creativity, the place for us to even to consider what is the new thing, right? Where are we going? But until I kind of at least at some level contend with what I'm legitimately feeling,
right?
What this loss of, because there were these promises held out that if we did the right things, if we did our political duty and we did all these things would hold.
Right.
What also flickered through my mind was at least in the American scene, the rules and the processes that were unchanging. Since I've been alive, the conversations about amendments to the Constitution has not really been a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the Constitution was written such that we would add, it's supposed to be a living document.
Right.
That's what amendments are for.
Right.
I'm not even pointing to a particular amendment, but just that concept of, okay, well, why haven't we done any more amendments? Mm. Why haven't we changed things? It's, the world is changing rapidly. How come there's like legitimately not one amendment that has needed to happen since the 1960s?
Right.
Really?
That's crazy. Right.
Yeah. And so perhaps just that challenging some of those models, since they're in upheaval anyway.
Right.
Might as well.
Right. And that's
kind of them and start to think about that.
Right. That's the premise of the book. They're in upheaval. Everything's in upheaval. I describe it slightly more positively as fluid. It's fast moving. It's changing. And yet a lot of our mental models remain fixed. And you've just pointed to one of them. You know, some things have moved along with the times and we embrace that and we enjoy that. So many of the constructs that shaped my understanding of how the world worked when I was little are gone, and we're okay with that. Stores are open 24 hours a day. People work so much of the 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. We could name a whole number of things that feel like they've started to get loose around the edges and create space and opportunity for reimagining. But I think a lot of what's happened is just a sort of bleeding out of old ideas rather than a fresh and bold and intentional reinterpretation of them. And I think the COVID experience with work was a great one. It sort of revealed to us that, hey, wait a second, work doesn't have to look the way it always has. If we accept the fact that it could be done differently, that we are allowed to rethink how we work. Well, are we really allowed? I mean, how far can we go? What are we allowed to do? And again, there's questions, there's questioning. And in general, I think we are raised to feel that questioning makes us difficult or demanding or problematic in some way. And yet it's a moment that is ripe for questioning, not in order to just tear down what's always been, because I think there are a lot of people who feel like that's the posture now of just questioning tradition and convention for the sake of it, but rather looking at them through the lens of, does it still work today? Do we need to make changes? There are so many ways in which progress and adaptation have become embedded into our lives. We fully accept the fact that cars can do things today that they couldn't do before. And so why in the world would we choose the old version? And yet there are other features of our world that remain stubbornly stuck in place and seemingly beyond the scope of our reimagination. Somebody was mentioning the nature of education, which looks on the outside for most people largely unchanged in terms of how you do it, what it looks like. You know, somebody said to me the other day, if mainstream education was a phone, it would be a BlackBerry. Like, it's literally trapped. And yet to suggest that it gets done differently is met with fear. I'm, I guess, in many ways trying to invite a more intentional conversation around adaptation and the ways in which we accept it readily and happily and treat it as progress, and the ways in which we somehow see it as being dangerous and revolutionary to say, as you've just said, surely over a course of a number of years, we're allowed to look at things and say, huh, isn't there a better way? Isn't there more? Isn't there different? Isn't there now? So I think giving ourselves permission to question in a spirit of creation and in creativity is a wonderful gift that I think we need to give ourselves right now.
seems to me that that might be a source of goodness and hope in dark times. Because we can look back at the ashes of what we've had and those hopes and dreams, and it's just not what it used to be. So
no.
Better, let's go ahead and intentionally step forward and start to investigate that.
Yeah, someone framed the moment as sort of the end of predictable progress. And I think that's a great framing because I think that's what a lot of people are feeling right now, whether you're a graduate, whether you're a young worker. There was a concept that things would get better. I describe it as the if-then world. If you did certain things, then you would continue to progress. And I think for a lot of people, that's where a lot of the grieving sits, which is that I don't feel in control of my progress anymore, and I don't know how to influence broader progress. I don't know what my role is in that. And that's where I think we need to start questioning ourselves and those closest to us to start with around how we might begin to re-experience progress, even when it feels like everything is going the opposite direction.
I want to get to that hope-filled space of where we'll get to. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, if I can come back to a little bit of the story when you had your previous book, mm-hmm. and as you were looking at the story of what it is to be an aid worker, what I want to be able to do is, as best I can, understand much of the undoing that you have experienced. Because we talked about what happened that eventually got you to the beautiful continent of Africa. And then you had this other undoing. And I had my own series of undoings. And so that really resonated with me. And so I'd love to explore that a little bit. And then I think out of that, then we get to the phoenix that rises out of the ashes a little bit. That may be a little bit more grandiose. But
yeah, okay. I'll go with it.
Kind of the hope that I'll say that permissions allow.
Yeah, you've got it.
You went with the intention of doing good and bringing... I say this just dripping with all the things that come with it, but the goodness of the West, the money that comes, the processes, and all of this wisdom. And you find out that perhaps maybe that's not exactly the way it works.
No.
So can you talk through a little bit of that? And I haven't spent any time with your book, Shame, which is one that I probably ought to go read for my own personal personal reckoning with things. But if you can tell a little bit of that story.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds very naive and cliche right now. The whole white savior thing has become such a, you know, has received the necessary public interrogation that it needed. But back then, I think there was still a great belief in the enterprise of charity, of aid, of the kind of debt that the West owed to other parts of the world in that sort of post-World War II era. So, yeah, I mean, I believed in the enterprise until I started to see that the levers of power that were being used were not only not having the beneficial effect that they were meant to, but they were also, in fact, squashing all the capabilities that actually needed to be in place in communities and countries in order for people to actually go about driving their own progress. One of the stories that I tell around the book is the kind of real reckoning that being that young director in that AIDS project brought for me, because there was just money coming in hand over fist. We couldn't spend it fast enough. There was the biggest AIDS epidemic in the world. And so everybody wanted to try and fix it. At a simple level, it made me deeply aware of the limitations of the concept of fixing anything as it relates to humans, as it relates to problems, as it relates to change. The directive was just spend, spend, spend. And don't worry if it's having an impact, because chances are it's doing good. So don't, to use your framing, ask too many questions. And then when I did start to ask questions about impact, about whether or not this was actually getting at some of the roots of the epidemic, it was a little bit of what I referenced earlier, which is, oh, you're just this young upstart. Put your head down and follow the script. And what's the problem? Tons of money is flowing into Zimbabwe. Why would you have an issue with that? So, you know, my own personal reckoning for the second time, my undoing with being in a script that I looked around and said, I'm not buying this. And I said to my director, we can give people everything in the world, but we can't give them permission. In other words, our presence with all of our grandiose resources was not enough to be the shift that was required for them to really come to grips with this epidemic. As I like to say, somebody has to decide that they're going to be the last one to do something, right? Or the first. Now, in my experience, human beings don't like to be the first or the last. So they don't want to be the ones to raise their voice or raise their hand or raise, you know, wait a second. Neither do they want to be the ones to say, enough, I'm not doing this anymore. Most of us get dragged along with whatever the default story is. So there wasn't enough money in the world to make somebody decide that they were going to face the wrath of their community in order to break centuries-old traditions or do things that Americans said they should do. And my presence wasn't enough to give people that permission. And so I think I realized that the most fundamental relationship in any change process is the one that you have with yourself, right? It's the quiet conversations that you have with yourself. It's the questions that you ask yourself first and foremost that are the game changers. It's, do I feel allowed to do the thing that I think I should, or they say I should? Do I really feel allowed to do it? Or does fear intervene in my own sense of permission? Are there external authorities whose power over me is so great that I'm not willing to take a risk? Or am I the thing that's in the way of me actually taking a risk to do something different? So I think when you talk about hope, for me, with the book and with the conversations I'm trying to be a part of right now, it's getting people to engage with themselves. It's getting people to tap into their own agency, their own sort of ability to green light choices that may or may not be the ones that have always been made, but they are the ones that suit them and serve this moment. Because I definitely look back on that period with a great sense of regret. My book is called Shame. And people were like, oh, you're too hard on yourself. You know, you did really good things. I was like, okay. And I am ashamed that I was a part of an industry with so much promise that delivered as little as it did. So I think the Phoenix Rising thing is around how I'm hoping to influence people to engage with themselves, because it's not about some external savior. You are your savior. You are your security. So how do you come into self in order to sort of find a little bit more of that within you?
And with all the uncertainties of AI, political upheaval, all of these things, yeah, it's going to get thrust on you.
It is.
If you don't lean into it.
Yeah. And I just, so keep repeating that because it's true.
Yeah. Whether you're religious or not, the savior is you is, what are the questions that you're asking? How are you poking into your own assumptions?
That's right.
And the ways in which you see the world, how are you testing those? What questions are you intentionally using, and what is your practice for going after that?
Yeah.
Because the train is going to come barreling down on you anyway. So better to be leaning into it, or at least have some control on this factor, be having a conversation around it internally, and then also with those around you, your community. With the promises of AI and all the conversations that are happening about whether all the jobs are going to disappear or not, or whatever that's going to look like, it's like we have this moment. We have a moment before more change does come. So how can we be intentional about getting after exploring this?
That's right.
And having this conversation.
Yeah, that's the moment that I'm hoping the book and these types of conversations steps into, because I do believe that we have a greater degree of control, if you will, or capability over with our own adaptivity than we allow ourselves to explore. Everything we've learned from the past 10 years to 20 years was around our own neuroplasticity, around the fact that actually we can continue to evolve and adapt. And we do. We know we do. So we never had to in the past, right? We weren't rewarded for it. We were rewarded for protecting the status quo. Now, as you say, if that's your mental model, the train is coming for you real fast. So your mental model needs to shift to, I am allowed to evolve and adapt routinely and intentionally in order to keep up with an evolving and adapting world. I am the only one who can drive that process, because nobody else can come in and say, Ken, it's fine. You're allowed to learn something new. You're allowed to try something new. You're allowed to go somewhere new. You have to make that decision. So the practice of questioning that you're referring to is, for me, in many ways, what I would call a permissions practice, which is constantly engaging with your default story about what you're allowed to do and who you're allowed to become. Because more often than not, we unconsciously self-limit in ways that we don't give ourselves consent to just try things and experiment and evolve and grow in the way that I think we're going to have to more than ever. In many ways, this is me kind of going, listen, I've been present for people stuck in the most painful stories, and they had nothing at their fingertips to help them move out of it. So this is a moment that is requiring a degree of adaptability that we probably haven't seen before. And besides that, please don't get to be 40 years old and stuck in a story that you don't want, or 20 years old or 25 years old. So the stories are here to be written, new stories, now stories, but you've got to allow yourself the power to do that and not just slip into whatever the default is that you came into this world with. And I don't think it's optional. I say to people, when I started writing this book during COVID, it was kind of like, it felt aspirational. Oh, wouldn't it be nice to allow ourselves to create lives for ourselves that felt more relevant to now? And now it's actually, that's not a choice you're going to make. You will be forced to make it. And are you going to be ready for that? Or are you going to be blindsided? I feel, as you say, there's a moment now where you have to decide.
What also came to mind as far as asking the questions about the permissions. If you're starting the process of asking the questions, it doesn't mean that you're going to burn everything down. No. It doesn't mean that at the end of this journal page, I'm now going to do Jill 2.0 and go to a new corner of the world and do things radically different. It's not that promise or that guarantee is not there, but it's the process of allowing yourself to ask those questions, to push into that. What are these, you know, as you talk through, you've got these 10 permissions. What are these questions that we're going to be asking ourselves to at least interrogate?
Yeah.
Interrogate our world such that we are doing this on purpose and by choice rather than, as you say, by default and just kind of get kind of pushed around. But I, because as you were mentioning that, I was like, that fear started to rise up in me as you were talking about interrogating these permissions. And I'm like, oh no, does that mean that if I start down this path, I'm going to go, I'm now destined for divorce? It's like, oh
yeah, no,
slow down, buddy. Slow yeah. down. There's no guarantee here, but at least starting the process, and it's almost giving yourself permission to have to give yourself permission
right.
to say that this is okay to yeah. start to ask.
Yeah. And it's so interesting for me because when one of the things that I've noticed in having these conversations around this, what you're calling interrogation, which is to me just the flip side of permission, you know, am I allowed?
Mm.
What's desirable? What's allowable? Is the fear that somehow the conclusion that you reach will lead you to want to blow up your life. Which then says to me, oh my gosh, does that suggest that the choices that you made are not ones that you want? That if you look too closely at them, they'd crack fairly quickly. You know, it's like, one, yes, you don't have to blow up your life. And in fact, I don't think you should. I think one of the issues with change is that we look for things that are big and high consequence. We've been conditioned to see change as around these big things, jobs and relationships and families and geography. And actually what happens often is that I think you make those changes. So you change, you move the furniture around, but you're left with the same person is sitting in the chair. You can swap something out. You can go and get a new job. But if you're hoping that that's going to be the thing that's going to spark the internal shift within you, very often it isn't. And you just find your same old self in an entirely different set of circumstances. For me, it's not about problem solving or fixing. It's about a practice of developing a capability within you for the kind of intentional choice that you're talking about. And that for me should start low consequence. Like, please don't start with your marriage. Please start with what you want to eat on a Saturday afternoon. Start with days, not years. Because most of us have so much more space within the existing confines of our lives to make deliberate choice than we ever allow ourselves to explore. So by accepting the current conditions and working within them, I think you actually find a degree of power that, you know, you don't necessarily find when you just go around trying to make big, bold window display moves in your life. It's like, just quietly start to explore all the scope and scale that you have on your weekends to do things, to create things, to make choices that reflect a greater expression or the fullest expression of yourself. And kindle that agency, kindle that intentionality in ways that just light up your existing life rather than thinking that you've got to change it all to experience some sort of feeling that you're hoping to have once you get there. I'm a huge fan of leisure time. You know, the root of that word is licere, which is to be permitted in French and in Latin. Mm. All the time when you're not working, all the time when you're just living, what do you want to do with it? What does it look like for you? How is it a vehicle for you to live and experience in ways that maybe you haven't fully lent into yet? So, no, this is not about people blowing up lives. This is about people finding so much new space in the ones that they have. And if that means that they begin to make much bigger, different choices, then okay. But I certainly wouldn't start there.
And that concept of the leisure time and perhaps reapplying that in new ways or repurposing it or being intentional, perhaps, the things that we've grown comfortable with and we've said that this is the only way that I can spend this time.
Right, exactly.
And so even to your point, if you start working with the most malleable pieces of your time, of your life, that leisure time is going to be the most malleable.
Yes.
And now you can play with that first.
Yeah. Play with that first. And also, I think part of the default story emerging from the late 20th century was that our work was everything, that we were our work. And now we see younger generations asking questions about that, being judged for those questions, simply because they're asking them. They're being judged as lazy and entitled and uninterested in the things that we accepted, certainly our generation. I think we took it hook, line, and sinker that work was our greatest expression of self. We aligned our identity so tightly with our jobs that we squeezed so much else out. And guess what? Our employers loved it because it meant that we killed ourselves at the altar of our profession. To the point that to embrace the multiple sides of yourself, to pursue something that wasn't monetizable, to get into something simply because it brought you pleasure or contributed something to your family, your community, whatever, was regarded as lesser than the thing that your primary source of employment. And I think that one of the things that we are seeing that we will continue to see is people beginning to ask questions of that story. And say, hold on a second. I want to place value on things that don't pay me, to I'm allowed to value relationships, and it doesn't make me unambitious if I do so. And three, I might have a whole range of things that I'm pursuing over the course of a lifetime. And my singular focus around a job or a role or a profession limits me from growing in ways that could be super interesting and valuable over the course of my lifetime. So even for people who are considering professional adaptation or evolution, I often say, okay, let's not start the conversation with should I quit my job? Because again, that's high stakes and not particularly malleable. Is there scope within the rest of your life to start to explore new communities, new ideas, new networks, so that it starts to inform that decision in ways that might lead you to broader possibilities than just, okay, let me telegraph from this job to the next one that looks exactly like that. So for me, there's so much scope around all the time around the edges of our work for us to begin to discover what we're capable of and what's possible.
What about the permission to pursue even the beginning of what you and defining of what you want? I have struggled with this, continue to struggle with this, because I've drank so deeply of the well of expectation of employment, production, and the rest. So I got that deep in my bones.
I hear you. I get it.
When folks will say, well, Ken, just what is it that you want? I'm like, I don't know, because I've never given myself permission to explore that.
Right.
Because my want is secondary, tertiary to anything else, because A, I'm a husband and a provider and a father, and I have these things, these stories that have put me on a track that my wants and desires are very subservient to these other things. And this is why I have so much respect. This is going to take a little bit of a left turn here. So much respect for those in the LGBTQ plus community. Mm. So I've had a long history as an evangelical Christian and Republican, all of these conservative things. And when I see these folks figuring out who they are and choosing that, I am like, I've got so much respect for, A, you done the work in figuring out what you want. So I'm jealous of that, right?
Right.
But then choosing to live in light of that.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
And live in a world that's pressing back.
Yeah.
So there's the motivational posters on business walls that talk about the man in the arena. And I'm like, just mad respect to those folks in that community because they are that person in the arena and they are choosing to live that every day of their lives.
Yeah.
And at real cost.
Yeah.
So coming back to this want or that willingness to figure out and having that bravery to figure out what it is that I actually want. How does your work and change and permissions work with that?
The first permission is be willful. And it was always going to be that because of just what you said. It's the single most transgressive thing any of us can do is to tap into that want, that will, that intrinsic desire, which at a very early age, most of us are taught is a problem. You know, it's greedy. It's potentially takes us astray. It's demanding. It's potentially weird. It's all the things we didn't want to be, right? Because we were being raised to be workers within systems where we executed on routine commands and tried to look like everybody else. You learn early on that your want is problematic. And understandably, we are socialized to fit within systems, our family system being the first one. And all of us have to exist within that frame of understanding the ways in which our wants coexist and coincide with others. I think with what is happening in the world right now, where what I would describe as outsourcing your wants to the world around you and having them tell you what you should want to be, to do, to become, is again becoming less rewarding because frankly, nobody knows.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. As we move towards wrapping up the conversation, I always like to ask guests, what is their right now question? So this is something beyond what's for lunch and who and if I'm going to get married, but this is more about the question of what are the things that you're thinking about right now and what questions are active in your life?
Oh, interesting. I'm thinking a lot about how can and how will my book and these permissions support people to navigate this age of AI. I feel like every day I read something about the latest innovation, the latest update alongside these sort of realities of the way that it's impacting work, the workforce, our understanding of how we navigate our lives. So I think it's really on my mind how the book can play a role in helping people to engage intentionally with how they prepare themselves for that, and how they regain a sense of control amidst it, because I think the effect of it all is to make us feel like we're at the mercy of this giant tech innovation. And I'd love to see it help people come back into themselves and have a greater sense of control as they move through this period. And alongside all the other rapid changes that are taking place, I really want to see this be a part of people's conversations with themselves first, with the people they love the most next, and then culturally, perhaps beyond that, of just what's possible in this time, what's allowable. We allow ourselves to imagine showing up to this moment differently, and what might that look like? So, yeah, I'm kind of allowing myself to watch it go out into the world and hopefully help some people as they find their way.
That seems like a lovely spot to be. As we plan to have this conversation, are there any elements of questions that we haven't touched on that you were hoping that we would?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, what a rich conversation. I've enjoyed every minute of it. No, I think that I really enjoyed the opportunity to kind of also look back at my own path and the way that it's led me to this. So, no, it's been a really rich reflection for me, and I hope that some of what we explored will feel resonant for other people.
Mm. That would be my hope as well. Wonderful. Where are the best places for folks to track you down to see what you're working
on? Yeah, my website's a perfect place, tempermissions.com. It's got everything that sort of is on the go right now. My email is there if people want to be in touch with me directly. You can find the links for buying the book there. It's on Amazon. It's available through Barnes & Noble. I'm active on LinkedIn. I'm active on Instagram at the moment. But LinkedIn is where I have more conversations and engagements with people. So, yeah, I really want to encourage people, if anything that we talked about today landed for them, to not feel afraid to give themselves permission to drop me a note. And I'm at a time with this book just coming out of feeling like very interested in how some of these themes are landing for people. So please take the time to reach out to me.
Wonderful. Well, Jill, thank you for bringing your expertise, your background, all of the varied experiences, and connecting that to questions and allowing us in the conversation to see how we might give ourselves permission to go explore a little bit more about what our world looks like. So thank you for being a part of the community here. I appreciate it.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Ken, for letting me in.
Absolutely.
Ken here. Jill provided some much-needed perspective about change and solutions through her new book, 10 Permissions, found at all major booksellers. My four takeaways are on the way, but I just wanted to reiterate my gratitude to the community for achieving the 100,000 download milestone. We are doing something good here. A reminder that the Curated Questions homepage includes the newsletter sign-up and a link to record your Right Now question, which may be included in an upcoming episode. Now, on to the takeaways. Number one, the questions as bridges framework. When entering unfamiliar territory, whether a new job, community, or life phase, Jill discovered that questions became her avenue forward in South Africa. Rather than letting assumptions or baggage precede you, leading with genuine questions creates safety and connection. As she notes, quote, people could just sense that I was curious, that all I wanted to do was to know more. This isn't about having the right questions, but about showing up with an authentic curiosity instead of answers. Questions become invitations for others to share who they really are beyond roles and expectations. Question. What situation in your life right now feels unfamiliar or uncomfortable, where you could experiment with leading with questions instead of assumptions? How might genuine curiosity change those interactions? Number two, the approval versus permission distinction. Jill's pivotal insight at 23 was realizing, quote, approval isn't the same as permission. While her parents disapproved of her leaving for South Africa, She recognized she didn't need their permission. She was funding it herself and willing to own the consequences. We often conflate others' approval with permission, believing people must buy into what we want to do. This keeps us trapped in patterns that no longer serve us. The truth is, as long as you feel solid about your choice and are prepared to deal with the outcomes, others' disapproval doesn't mean you're not allowed to pursue it. Question: where in your life are you waiting for approval when what you actually need is to give yourself permission? What would change if you separated these two concepts this week? Number 3, making space for grief. When Jill was discussing change, she said, "I think we're grieving so much of what we once knew, what we once counted on, and what we once believed in as the stories that shaped our understanding of how the world worked." I became quiet during this part of the conversation because I felt a shift as Jill named what I had been experiencing. There has been so much upheaval and loss in recent days, months, and years. And now I understand I haven't mourned the loss of the familiar. As I reflected on this realization, I decided to start a grieving journal as a place to record and acknowledge the loss. It will include the death of my sister, a lost friendship, and the tearing down of the White House East Wing. With the grief expressed, perhaps there will be space for the imagination to accept what is ahead. Question: how might you make space to process loss and grief that continue to weigh you down? Number 4, the danger of outsourcing your wants. The first of Jill's 10 permissions is be willful, which she calls the single most transgressive thing any of us can do. From an early age, we learn our wants are problematic, greedy, demanding, potentially weird. So we outsource them, letting the world tell us what we should want and to become. But as Jill observes, this is becoming less rewarding because, frankly, nobody knows. When you've spent decades making your wants secondary, tertiary, or anything else, even the question, "What do you want?" becomes impossible to answer. Question: can you identify 3 shoulds that are currently driving your decisions? What would happen if you spent 10 minutes each day this week asking yourself what you actually want without editing or judging the answers? And that's it for this episode. Drop in the comments section of your favorite podcast player the moments that resonated with you. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.